Okay, so we're recording now. Today is May 24th, 2012. This is Desiree Hargis working on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports, and as part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project and Legacy Archive. Today I'm interviewing Toni Hewitt Cervantes over the phone about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Toni, can you begin with when and where you were born, and any clarifications on your name, if you have any?
Yes. I was born September 29th, 1951, in San Francisco, California. Hewitt I was adopted by my stepfather, so I don't use that name. I went back to my birth name, which was Cervantes. And quite frankly, I'm not exactly sure who my father is. It's a little bit fuzzy. But in any case, Cervantes was the person my mother was married to when I was born. So I happened to like him a lot. And I took that name back when I was in my 30s.
Wonderful. Thank you for clarifying that. And you grew up in San Francisco.
No, actually, my parents were, my mother and Henry were living in Oakland, but my mother wanted me to be born in San Francisco. And so she drove herself across the Golden Gate Bridge, and the World Series was on, so he didn't go with her. So she drove herself to San Francisco across the bridge, and actually the Bay Bridge, not the Golden Gate Bridge. And I was born there, but I lived in Oakland until I was in the second grade, and then moved to Orange County, Newport Beach.
Aha.
Uh-huh. And that's where I started to train, was down there. I used to, my parents, my mother and my stepfather belonged to a private club called the Balboa Bay Club, and they had these little races on 4th of July and Labor Day and Memorial Day. And for some reason, I would always win, I guess because I was good. And one day, a friend of ours that we knew asked my mother if I would like to go to the Harbor Area Boys Club and join the swim team. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a swim team. I was 9, almost 10 years old. And I said, okay, all right, why not? And at that time, my coach did the summer leagues at the in Orange County, but he coached the men's high school team at Newport Harbor High School, and he'd never really taken on a female before as an athlete, except for in the context of the summer league. And asked my mom if I wanted to train with the team, and she said, yeah. I said, okay. I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, but I guess I was pretty good, pretty fast. I remember my first race, I had to swim 100 meters in the 25-meter pool, and after 50 meters, I pushed off the wall, and I put my feet on the bottom. I was so freaking tired, and everybody was waving their arms, go, 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 and I'm like, all right, okay. So I just kept going. I didn't know what I was doing. But then I just got very good very fast. And I was actually a freestyler, a sprinter, and was the fastest in the world when I was 11 years old for my age. And then somebody had some strange, weird idea to make me into a distance swimmer. And I hated it. I hated it. I remember thinking, when is this going to be over? It's just so long. I was in the 1500 meters, and I didn't mind the 400, but the 1500 was just so mind-numbingly boring. And then I lost my speed, so I couldn't sprint anymore. I thought, great, what am I going to do now? And I always liked the way the butterfly looked. I thought, well, that's a pretty stroke. Let's give that a shot. And I remember the day that I was swimming, and all of a sudden, my stroke, my rhythm, everything just came together. And I said, that's it. I'm a butterfly. I'll forget it. All that other stuff.
That's a great story. So, and how old were you when you discovered the butterfly and made that your stroke?
13.
Mm. Did you have any major influences in terms of your sporting life at the time?
Oh, I looked up to a lot of the athletes. I mean, I looked up to Murray Rose was one in particular. He just recently died, and I just thought he was the most handsome man on the whole planet. And Donna DeVerona was also, I just thought she was so beautiful and athletic. And yeah, they were inspirations to me. And I had a really weird situation. I wasn't really on a swim team. I was kind of the only one. You know, there was one girl who lived with our family that trained with me, and she and I were really the only two who swam with the men's team. And I remember working out. I don't remember any other girls doing this, but I spent a lot of time in the weight room. And I remember feeling very embarrassed that I was sweating, because at that time, you know, girls were supposed to glow. They weren't supposed to sweat. And so here I was, a girl working out in the weight room with all these guys, and feeling completely shy and embarrassed. And yet at the same time, you know, putting my heart and soul into it. So there was a lot of confusion around that, actually. But now it's so great because the women, God, they do everything, you know, with panache and without any embarrassment. I mean, they just go for it. And I just think that's such a huge difference in sports nowadays. We were kind of at the forefront of a lot of things, and certainly alternative training was one of them. And some of my other influences, well, I would say that anybody who, not just in the athletic world, but anybody who expressed any kind of courage in the face of
adversity.
Adversity. Thank you. Adversity. There were political leaders that I really looked up to that I was very inspired by. There were athletes. There were artists. You know, that anybody who dedicated their lives to a passion were all inspirations to me. Writers were inspirations to me.
Okay. Did you have any family members that also participated in sports?
Family members?
Yeah.
Nope. My brother was a very good runner. He was a swimmer and a water polo player, but he moved on to running. He was very athletic, but not the level I was. No, there really wasn't, because I just had a very strange upbringing. I didn't have any relatives, so nope, nobody in my family.
So what was the rest of your middle school and high school swimming career like?
Well, as I mentioned, I started rather late. It was about a month and a half before I turned 10, which most swimmers start at 6, 7, 8. I started training, and, when I was in elementary school or junior high school, I trained with a high school team. And when I was in high school, I trained with the college men's team. So I was never really with my peers. And my coach never went to my swim meets. My mother always took me, since I was the only one, and he was considered himself primarily a water polo coach. I was pretty much on my own throughout my career, with the exception of my mother, which wasn't particularly fun having her around. But so it was a very unusual. I didn't have sort of the luxury and the fun of being on a big team, you know, where you're all kind of pulling together. And in my workouts in the summertime, I would start my workout by myself, because my coach was either with the lifeguards that he was training or the water polo team. And I would also finish my workout by myself. And so I was very much, pretty much on my own with my friend Janice Allen, the two of us. So we'd start and finish our workouts by ourselves.
Hmm.
It was a very strict... What's that?
Oh, I was going to ask, why did you say it wasn't very fun to have your mother around?
Well, my mother was... her identity got very much intertwined with mine. If I did well, you know, she was very proud and very loving. If I didn't do well, then she was very rejective of me. And so it just, there was always that tension that I wasn't pleasing her and or that I was doing something wrong. But I really believe that nobody ever gets to the level that I did unless they really want to do it. But, you know, trying to do it for the love of your parent or the love of your coach or the, you know, it's like trying to quit smoking. You can quit smoking for somebody else, but it only lasts for a short time. If you do it for yourself, then you'll have results. And I feel the same way about swimming, that I never could have achieved what I did had I not wanted to do it. But there was a lot of confusion around, you know, whether or not my mother really loved me or if it was just a matter of how I made her look.
Hmm.
And I don't think that's unusual, quite frankly. You know, a lot of parents get very involved with their children's performance because they do dedicate a lot of money, time, effort, and that kind of thing. And then it gets confusing for them, too. But in particular, my mother was not particularly kind. But I guess she did the best she could, and.
Yeah, what you described is not unusual at all. It's probably very, very common. Well, I know it is. So
yeah.
Tell me a little bit about some of your biggest meets and experiences leading up to 1968.
I would say, well, when I broke a minute in the 100-yard freestyle, I was 11, and at that time I was the youngest person to go that fast at that age, and that I remember that race very, very well. I remember the first time I swam butterfly, I was 9 years old at the Harvard Area Boys Club. And he says, okay, we're going to dive off the pool, edge of the pool, and we're going to swim butterfly across the pool. We're going to do 25. And I dove into the water, and then I realized I didn't know what the butterfly was. And I popped up, and I said, well, what's the butterfly? And so that was my first introduction to the butterfly and not knowing what the heck it was. But I would say that I know one memorable thing. In 1967, I was very sick when I went to the indoor nationals, and I had been sick before I went, and my coach said, oh, you shouldn't go, you know, blah, 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 blah. And my mother said, no, she's going. So that was the first time he'd ever gone to the nationals with me. He had decided that he told me in 1966, after a very bad year, that he was going to go to the nationals with me in 67 and 68, and that I was going to make the Olympic team. Now, he had never made that kind of commitment to me before. I had never asked him to make that kind of commitment. And I was like, wow, oh, wow, okay, that's great. So in 67, he said I shouldn't go, and my mom said, of course, she's going to go. So I went, and I qualified sixth, and I got fourth. And he was so shocked and surprised and so proud that he said, you're going to beat all these women this summer in long meters. And I did. And not only that, when we were flying back to Philadelphia, we were flying on the plane, and he wrote down the time I was going to do and my splits at the 50, the 100, the 150, and what my final time would be in the 200 butterfly. And I just looked at him and I thought, oh my God, that's like 2 seconds faster than I've ever gone. But I thought, okay. And I not only won it, But I did exactly, I was one-tenth off from what he had projected I was going to do. And that was a really big moment for me. And then, of course, in 1968, they were using the electronic timing, and I believe it was the very beginning of using the electronic timing, where instead of a tenth of a second, it would be 1/100th of a second that they could calibrate the time. And I, in the 100 butterfly, which was my first event trying out for the team, in the finals, I got third place by 1/100th of a second. The person who got fourth place was Sharon Stadter, who was a gold medal winner in 1964 and the world record holder. And she and her coach wanted to have a swim off, and that didn't happen because I had beaten her by 1/100th of a second. So that was pretty, you know, by talking about the skin of your teeth. And then in Mexico, we were in training camp, and I remember I was doing so well, and I just knew that I was gonna. That I was going to get a medal, if not the gold medal. I won the 200 butterfly, by the way, at the Olympic trials in 68. And then a couple of days before we were going to leave training camp and go to Mexico, my coach called me and said he wasn't going to come to Mexico. And I had a meltdown. I just felt very abandoned. Everybody else was having their coach there. I was the only one who didn't have their coach. And I just felt like there wasn't a person in the world that I could count on.
Why did he?
And he had a water polo tournament. And now why he didn't know that before, I don't know. I can't answer that. In fact, when I talked to him about it about 15 years ago, he didn't even remember. He missed my first two races. Apparently, my mother got him on the phone and, you know, begged him to come. He missed my first two races, but I was such a basket case by that time that all my rhythm went away. Everything, I was just, it was gone. I mean, I did my best to try and get it back, but I felt, I just put me in a tailspin. And I think, you know, for many, many years, I blamed myself for not being mentally strong enough to overcome this adversity. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I realized that, you know, I was really just 16, just turned 17 years old. I had problems with my family and my mother, and I counted on my coach. You know, he would always say, do you want me to lie to you, or do you want me to tell you the truth? So I always thought of him as an honest person and a person who would do what he said. And say what he meant. So when he said he wasn't going to come, I was just, I didn't know anything anymore. And I realized that in my 30s that I actually did pretty damn well, considering, you know, that in my mind now is a betrayal of trust. And, you know, it's the most important event of my entire life that I've spent 8 years training for, and that he spent 8 years training me. He's not going to come? Yeah, that was hard for me.
Mm-hmm. Do you think maybe he was concerned about the security or some of the other, like, political and social things?
Not even close. No. He was a men's coach. He was thought of himself as a water polo coach, and so he felt letting them... I don't know how he felt. You'd have to ask him.
Okay.
You'd have to ask him, but okay. I don't know.
So, how was your training and competition supported?
At which time in my life?
Just prior to the Olympics and during the Olympic training.
Well, it was the same thing. You know, I was still beginning and ending my training by myself in the summertime. And then he came to my Olympic trials and my nationals in 1967 and 1968. And the rest of the time, my mother came. And my mother actually came to, you know, obviously the Olympic trials. But we trained at, Colorado Springs the Air Force Academy, and we were there for a number of weeks, I think five weeks, I think, in preparation for high altitude. And I was doing great. I mean, what's interesting is that I was training in a long distance pool, which is a 50 meter pool, but my training throughout the year, I always trained in a short course pool, which was a 25 yard pool. So I never saw a 50 meter pool until I went to a swim meet. So this was the first time I'd actually trained in a 50 meter swimming pool, and I was doing great. I had great hopes. I felt very confident, until I got that call from my coach, Newland. Mm-hmm. That I fell apart. I just fell apart.
What was your coach's name again?
Ed Newland from UC Irvine.
Ed, and how do you spell the last name?
Newland, N-E-W-L-A-N-D.
Thank you. It's just, some of the little sounds are harder to pick up over this connection.
Oh, yeah. No, he's a very well-known water polo coach. I mean, believe me, he's notorious. That's for sure. Newland.
Okay. I'll have to look him up again. So, were most of your friends on swim teams or elite athletes as well, or did your training affect your friendships and other relationships?
Are you talking about in high school? Since I didn't belong to a team, I was always on the outside, because when I was in junior high school, I trained with a high school men's team. When I was in high school, I trained with a college team. And because I was a swimmer and going to meets all the time and training, and I never really developed strong friendships in high school. My closest friend was Janice, who lived with our family for 3 years while she was training. Which was great because I had one friend anyway. But as far as like in high school, really going to parties and things like that, I didn't. I really didn't have that experience that most people do in high school. And of course, it was before there were girls' high school swim teams and college teams where you could get scholarships. It was all, you know, AAU independent teams. That there were no programs in the high schools or in the colleges at that time where you could kind of connect in that way. I mean, there kind of was, but it was, you know, there was no coach or anything like that. I don't even remember if we had swim meets. We probably did, but I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
Title 13 or Title 9 changed everything.
Yeah, definitely. How did your family and friends or your hometown or your schoolmates react to finding out that you were going to go to the Olympic Games?
Well, I think they were very proud. I mean, when I came back from Mexico at one of the football games, they introduced me and I had on my uniform and stuff like that. No, they were very proud. I mean, but interestingly enough, and a couple of friends, you know, made a big card for me and sent it to me on my birthday, which was right before the Olympics, which, and that was nice. But still, because I didn't have a close family and I didn't have any relatives, when I was in Mexico and going through the problems that I did, and there's another issue that I'll talk to you about later, I felt like I didn't have a friend in the world. I mean, it never occurred to me that there were people, you know, outside my immediate family who were pulling for me. And I think that's because you depend so much on the support of your family and your parents. And when you feel like you don't have that or you don't have the support of your coach, you don't really think that anybody else is going to give a shit. Hold on just a second. I'm going to get a blanket. It's freezing in this farmhouse. Hold on.
Okay.
And I used to feel as though if I said anything about any of this stuff to anybody, that it would sound like I was making excuses. And so that was one thing, you know, that my coach always said, you know, don't be a pussy, don't make excuses, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so I never did. I mean, but through a lot of self-analysis and also therapy, you know, I was able to come to terms with the situation and not blame myself for not doing as well as I had hoped that I was going to do.
Yeah, and I'm sure it helped to have somebody put it into perspective, you know, of all the swimmers in the world, how extremely well you did do.
Yeah, I think I did. I think I, under the circumstances, you know, I did pretty well. Was it a disappointment? Yes. Do I wish I would have done better? Yes. Was I physically capable of doing better? Of course. If I had been a different person, or if I'd had a different experience, I would have done better. I would say, of course, part of it's my fault that I couldn't overcome it, but I do think that given the circumstances of feeling abandoned by my family and my coach, that was a lot for a 16-year-old to take on.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that kind of situation.
So did anybody from your family go down to Mexico to watch you compete?
Oh, yeah. My mom was there. My coach... yeah. My coach was there, but he showed up after I'd already swum two races. My mother and my stepfather were there. But my mother, she took everything personally. And so right before the finals of the 200 butterfly, she was very upset with me. And I'll tell you about why later. She got very upset with me and wouldn't talk to me. And my stepfather, who was scared to death of my mother, said, you know, you should just go apologize to your mother. And I said, but it's not my fault. I didn't do anything. And he said, yeah, I know, but let's just keep peace in the family. So this is what was going on like 2 hours before the biggest race of my life, the finals of the 200 butterfly. I had to take care of my mother and her disappointment in me. And her anger at me. So it was not the greatest situation. And then when I lost, of course, she wouldn't speak to me and she turned around and walked away. So, you know, the experience of Mexico for me was kind of very bittersweet. Very bittersweet, yeah.
It sounds there like
was some very amazing things, but also some very, very deeply emotional things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, when you were in Colorado Springs training at the high altitude training camp, did you notice any of the effects of the high altitude?
Yeah, I think so. Surely in the beginning, but I think that I really acclimated, as many of us did. I was in Mexico City in 1965, by the way. They took three experimental teams down, 65, 66, 67. To study high altitude effects on performance, and you know, they were taking your blood and checking your oxygen deprivation and all this stuff. But I ended up getting very sick when I was in Mexico in 1965, and I don't even remember swimming my races, quite frankly. But I had gone from sea level to Mexico City, so I do feel as though and I hadn't done any training at high altitude, so I think the effects of that were much greater in 1965. But one of the things I remember that was kind of sweet in 1965, remember there was a Cold War going on, and and the Russians and the Americans, you know, are bitter enemies and stuff. And I was 13, just turned 14 years old, and I was lying on the side of the pool, just couldn't move, very sick. And I'll never forget this big Russian swimmer. I think he was the world record holder in the breaststroke, and his name was Propinpinko. I can't remember his first name, but it was Propinpinko. And he was so sweet. He looked to be like in his mid-20s. He seemed older to me. He was kind of like a big bear. And he came over to me, and he sat down next to me, and I looked up at him. You know, I was just feeling horrible, and he took his one of those Russian hats, you know, that has the flaps on the side that you pull down over your ears.
Mm-hmm.
And he took that hat and he put it on my head. And he just stayed there with me, holding my hand. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And I still have that hat today. I still have that hat.
That's amazing. That's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing that happened in 1965 is there was a really handsome Italian guy on the swim team, and he gave me his Italian sweat jacket that said Italia on it with his name. And he was on the national team, and I think a year later, the team was flying somewhere to Italy or somewhere in Europe, and the plane went down, and he was killed in an airplane crash.
Oh, my goodness.
But, yeah, those are two things. Those are the two things that I actually remember that the most about 1965. The other thing I remember, which is, I don't know if I should even talk about this, but since you're asking, 1965. So before we went, we had to get our passports, and my mother, she called somebody somewhere in Alabama, and this woman, who apparently was her aunt, had to verify her birth date because her records had burned down in a courthouse fire. And so she needed that information so that my mother could get a passport, which kind of goes to the fact that I didn't know anything about my mother. That was the only name that I have of any relative. So it was kind of interesting that I remember that was the only contact in all my life that I know that she ever had with anybody from her relatives or past. So it was all very mysterious. You know, my mother was very mysterious. I didn't know anything about her. I didn't know what her parents' names were. I actually didn't even know what her real name was until she died, and I found out. But she died 2 years ago. So, you know, she's a very mysterious woman and, you know, obviously had a very hard life herself. So anyway, so that's what I remember about 1965. And feeling the effects of the altitude at that time. But in 68, I felt as though I acclimated very well. I was actually just doing incredibly well, swimming unbelievably fast until my coach, until I got that phone call from my coach. And I remember the workouts were way longer than I'd ever done before. They were 3 hours in the morning, I think 2 hours in the afternoon. I usually swam like an hour and a half or 2 hours in the morning and an hour and a half in the afternoon. So the workouts for me were much longer. And I remember being so darn hungry and eating more than I'd ever eaten in my life. And, you know, we went through the buffet at the Air Force Academy. And I remember feeling, you know, this was the time of the Vietnam War, feeling really uncomfortable eating in the mess hall because of the hazing that went on towards the freshman men. You know, the way they had to eat, they had to look straight ahead and eat like a robot. I mean, they would take a spoonful of food, lift it straight up, and then straight into their mouth like a 90-degree angle, and they couldn't speak unless spoken to, and they were constantly being harassed while they were eating. And I thought, this is just not right. This is wrong. So I remember that the seniors all had, what do you call those cars? There's Chevys, but they're like really fancy ones. They all got the same card. And because at the end, when they were seniors, they graduated and they were given a car. And they all got these like muscle cars.
Mm-hmm.
Same one. They all got the same one. And I thought, wow, this is the way they treat each other. And they all think the same and they all dress the same. And they don't seem to be really nice people to each other. So I sort of, it was also the same year that Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated and Martin Luther King was assassinated, and that really affected me deeply. I remember waking up in the morning and my stepfather was standing in front of the television and saying, Bobby Kennedy was just assassinated. But we still went to work out, got in the car, went to work out. Same thing happened when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. We didn't cancel workout, that's for sure. But I remember it was very, very quiet. Mm-hmm. Very quiet. And usually my coach would be walking up and down the pool deck yelling at us and stuff, but he just kind of leaned against the fence, as quiet as could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember one of the swimmers saying, well, he thought that Kennedy got just what he deserved. And I thought, I am so out of my place in Orange County. I just don't belong in this town. It's so conservative. And plus, the other thing is that I'm Native American. I'm a person of color. I grew up in a very predominantly, if not predominantly, exclusively white neighborhood and area. I was sort of the token Indian who, you know, so nobody really... There wasn't any prejudice about it. I was sort of an anomaly, I guess. But I never felt comfortable because I was different. I was always different. So 1968 was tremendously influential to me because of what was going on socially throughout the country. What was going on with the civil rights movement. It's like everything was exploding around us. The Vietnam War, I was, you know, riveted to the television every night. My parents were Republicans, and I was drifting. I wasn't a Republican. I loved John F. Kennedy. And to this day, you know, I'm a great admirer of him and his family, and his assassination is a tremendous influence on my life, as was Bobby Kennedy and Malcolm X and all of these people. But 1968, when I was at training camp, one of the other things I remember was getting letters. I believe I got letters from Dr. Harry Edwards,
uh-huh.
who was... sort of a consultant to Tommy Jet Smith and John Carlos and some of the other guys on the Olympic team, the men's track team, talking about, and I can't be 100% specific, but I can say that generally what I remember is them talking about the Black Power issues. And as I recall, and I could be wrong on this, and this could just be sort of something I'm making up and don't recall, but I think that he was talking about having Black people on the swim team. And I was thinking, damn, I earned my spot on this team, and I'm not giving it up to anybody. So it was a confusing time, but it was also a very provocative time. And, you know, this deeply affected me. And I remember being in Mexico and being there at the opening ceremonies and... walking into the stadium, and we got, you know, big applause. But when Hungry came through, People were screaming and yelling because Hungary had been taken over, had been in occupied by Russia that year. They had come in and I guess invaded or whatever you call it. And so Hungary got a tremendous reception as they came in. So all of this talking and what people were saying back in those days, oh, you know, that the Olympics aren't political. Well, that's just not true. And it never has been true. Not from the very beginning has it ever been true. You know, it's just some kind of idealistic elitist myth that people wanted to think. And it just wasn't the case. And I began to see that it was really the beginning of a tremendous political awakening for me. Being in the Olympic Village and seeing like African men holding hands as they're walking through the village and looking at that and going, well, that's really strange. And then beginning to understand that this is a different culture. They have a different way. And I was learning not to judge other cultures by my own experience. And I think it was a political awakening because of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King. And I followed the civil rights movement and I was deeply ensconced in learning all of that. You know, I read all of these books, The Invisible Man and Black Like Me. So I was educating myself about these issues, because I found them fascinating. And I was fascinated by Black people because I thought they were so beautiful and so talented and soulful and so much. They had so much flavor in their culture compared to where I was brought up, Orange County, which was at that time, like I said, exclusively Caucasian in Newport Beach, where everything seemed to be so polished, and which is great, you know, for some people. But for me, being a person of color in that world, something didn't feel right. I didn't really know what it was, and I didn't really understand it until I was older. And I look back and I go, oh, that's why I felt kind of out of place there. And oddly enough, my mother, who was from Alabama, you know, she wouldn't allow us kids to ever say any racial epithet. So I did learn that from her. And the odd thing about that is that as she got older, you know, I only saw her a couple of times, but she became really a bigot, and which kind of shocked me because that actually wasn't the way I was raised. So, anyway, where were we? I'm just kind of rambling now.
No, this has been great. Well, I wanted to ask, you were talking about the social and political environment during the games and during 1968. Do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico
Absolutely.
City?
Yes, I do remember hearing about that. In fact, I found out years later that they were actually thinking about canceling the games because there had been, the military had blown up a number of apartment buildings where people lived. They were looking for a couple of different people and didn't clear the place. And a lot of people were needlessly killed. Of course, I knew the student protests that were going on the campuses. In fact, I wanted to go to UC Berkeley. My mother wouldn't allow me to go there because she thought I'd turn into a radical, which I did when I went to UCLA. Anyway, so hold on. Hold on just a second. The housekeeper's coming in. I have to tell her. Hold on just a second.
Okay.
Where was I?
We were talking about the violence in Mexico City and the student protests.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I knew that there were a lot of student protests that were going on. I think it was, as I learned later, it was much greater than anybody knew. I think they were keeping, as I understand it, a lot they weren't releasing a lot of information because they didn't want to postpone or cancel the game. But I do remember hearing a lot about that. I think the Mexico City, it wasn't the altitude so much that was the problem. What the problem was, one of the many, many problems was the poor accommodations The distance between places, the traffic was unbelievable. I mean, as I recall, one of the swimmers got stuck in traffic and missed his event. Somebody else got stuck in an elevator. I know myself that I was freezing in my room. There weren't enough blankets. The rooms were cold, and the plumbing wasn't working very well. And unfortunately for me, because I came from that background from Newland of Don't Ever Complain, I was afraid to ask for, you know, extra blankets because I thought that someone would think I was being, you know, a wimp or something like that. And this was one of the things about athletics that I think that I have learned is that you have to speak up for yourself and you have to let people know how you're feeling and what's going on and not suck everything up because you're afraid of being, teased for being a pussy or being, a crybaby or whatever it is that athletes like to call each other if they say something, but anyway, so we were back to Mexico. I didn't like that you couldn't go in the pool right before your race because that was the way, you know, you would warm up and then there would be like an hour before your race and you couldn't get into the pool again. You know, I didn't like that. I thought that was really poor planning. They should have built an extra pool where you could be in the pool right before, you know, you get on the block so you can loosen up. But to go cold into a race after standing around for an hour or whatever it was, that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that kind of organization was terrible. There were many things that I remember. You know, the barefooted Ethiopian Abibi, he was tremendously influential and inspirational. Bob Beeman, when I saw him flying out of the pit and crying and finding out later that he went back to the United States and he couldn't get a job. I mean, you know, the inequities became very clear to me. How, you know, the United States wants you to win all these gold medals and then at that time you went back to the States and there was nothing for you. There was no support, there was no, you know, help in trying to get work or whatever. It's like every man for himself, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a huge, huge awakening, in many, many ways. Internationally, domestically, civil rights, the inequity of all kinds of things. But yeah, I knew about the protests, and of course, when the Black Power movement came around, I was mesmerized by these men who so boldly. In fact, when I went back to complete my senior year of high school, we had to do I was in a speech class and I had to give a speech on a subject that was important to me. And I chose that moment and I talked about the heroic courage that they expressed in the face of adversity and what an impression it had on me. Whereas everybody else that I recall was mortified by what they had done. As though it was anti-American, it was anti-patriotic, or unpatriotic, and totally inappropriate. And I remember them being kicked out of the place we were living. I forget what it's called now.
The Olympic Village.
Yeah, the Olympic Village. Kicked out of the village, and all the hoo-ha with the press was there, and all the officials were there. And the reason why this has particular interest to me is because I became friends with a runner on I think he was from Trinidad and Tobago. He and I became friends. And we were hanging out a little bit in the village. And I was a bit enamored with him. I thought he was a really interesting guy and stuff like that. And we just had a great time. And for some reason, I really gravitated towards, you know, some of the guys on the track team. There was another American guy that I became friends with. And he was about my age. And, my God, I can't remember his name right now. But he's the nicest guy in the world. But it was what I was interested at the time was civil rights. I was interested in, you know, I felt somehow connected with this culture. And I had never really felt that connected with the Caucasian swimming culture. I always felt on the outside. And this caused a huge uproar, this friendship that I had. And my friendships with some of the other black guys on the track team. And it was such a big uproar that apparently the coaches all got together, and the persons who were, I don't know, all the officials for the swim team, and I'm not sure who else, and they had a meeting to decide whether or not they were going to kick me off the team.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so here I am, part of an American team that is multicultural. We're there for our country. And I'm not supposed to associate with black people on the track team. And they're thinking about kicking me off. And it was a scandal. In fact, a year ago, I met this woman in Santa Cruz. And she said that she used to swim. And her coach was Don Gamble. And I said, oh, say hello to Don for me. You know, I used to swim too. And I said, but tell him that Tony Hewitt said hello because he won't know me by Tony Cervantes. And she said, Tony Hewitt? You're Tony Hewitt? I said, yep. She goes, oh, my God, you are the one who is going to get thrown off the team because of that black guy you were friends with. I said, how did you know that? And she said, well, my mother told me because she went down to watch the Olympics and a bunch of and she didn't even have any children who were participating. She just went down as a spectator. And there were a bunch of people sitting around talking about it. So I thought that this was kind of a small thing. But apparently, you know, everybody who was involved with swimming knew about it. So here it was, not only had I been abandoned by my coach and the feeling that my mother was just so erratic, but I was also being... they were going to throw me off the team.
Wow. That's something else.
Yeah. So that's why my mother was very upset with me before my race. She was saying, you're in love with him. I said, I'm not in love with this guy. He's just a friend. So you know, she was like, all the sympathy was supposed to go to her and all the concern and oh, somehow I had wronged her and this and that and the other. And it was so blown out of proportion. It wasn't anywhere near what anybody was made. I was a friend with this guy and, you know, a couple of other guys. And this became like a scandal for which I was going to be punished.
Wow. So that's the reason she was acting so coldly and upset with you.
Yeah.
Well, was there anyone else on either the U.S. team or on any of the other international teams with whom you developed friendships or spent time with?
My roommate was Susie Jones, and she was a doll, but I wasn't really close to anybody on the team. I felt... Susie Jones was a friend. Jane Swaggerty was a little bit of a friend. But again, you know, I tried to be friends, but the majority of the team came from the same swim team. Like 16 people on the team were from Santa Clara Swim Club. You know, a number of people were from Arden Hills. There were, they had kind of the lion's share. So they all knew each other. I was like one little person who had no affiliation with anybody. I was the only one from my swim team because I was the only one on the team. And, you know, there were a few individuals here and there. I roomed with Susie Shields, who was really sweet gal from Kentucky, and she was also a competitor of mine, and we were friends, but I don't think that I ever really was very close to anybody, no.
Hmm.
No, I was pretty shy. I read a lot, and yeah.
What are your memories of what it was like to be a woman or a female competing in the games in 68? How were you treated by the men?
Oh, I think, you know, I think it was fine. I do remember that we had to have a sex test. You know, this was the age in which a lot of the Soviet female athletes were. I remember in 1965 when I was in Mexico and seeing some of these women, the shot putters and the hammer throwers and stuff, and some of the runners from Russia and the Eastern Bloc countries who looked like women with mustaches. And of course, European women at that time didn't really shave under their arms or their legs very much. It was just a cultural thing. So, you know, just compounded the fact that they looked more masculine. But then there became sort of a real concern that maybe some of these women weren't women, or maybe they had an extra X chromosome, or maybe they were men taking female hormones, or, you know, whatever. So in 1968, I believe that was the first time they ever did the sex test. And I remember walking in there thinking, oh my God, they're going to make me take off my pants and they're going to look, you know, down in my private parts to check and see if I'm a female, because nobody told me what they were going to do. And I went in there and they just scraped the inside of my mouth. I thought, oh, well, that's a relief. And then I got my certificate that certifies that I'm a female, which I thought was kind of funny now that I look back. So I got that along, I guess, with being a member of the Olympic team. So it was quite an Olympic Games, I can tell you that. I can tell you that. The traffic, the weather was cold. The smog was unbelievably awful. A lot of people were getting sick. And then, of course, the political backdrop to everything that was going on was fascinating. I mean, I was fascinated by everything that was going on. You know, I was kind of overwhelmed by all of the things that were happening. And we were swimming in a different pool all the time and, you know, trying to get our hours into training. And it was a mess. I mean, it was really, it was not very well thought out or organized or functional.
Hmm. So I'm going to ask you a question about memory, but you're one of the few that I've talked to that actually remembers the blood draws for the performance testing and altitude and performance testing that went on before the games, in 65 mm-hmm. and 66. And you're also one of the few that remembers the gender testing.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that might be that the women don't remember the gender testing and that many of those that participated in the science of performance don't remember those blood draws?
Because I'm terrified of needles. I think that's why I remember. And also, I was very, very sick in 1965. I mean, I was like deliriously ill. You know, I was going at both ends and I think because I was so sick and laid out on the side of the pool and had that experience with that Russian guy. And again, I've always been fascinated by history and politics, and, very interested in, what was going on between the United States and Russia. It was also a time when we were like doing drills in case there was an atomic attack, and we were like hiding under the desk. So, you know, I was fascinated by anything that I was not supposed to be connected to, like the black culture and Russians. And, you know, anything that they said I shouldn't be doing or interested in or stay away from, I was interested in. And so And the sex test, I think, because I was so afraid they were going to pull my pants down, that, you know, I think that's why I remember this tremendous feeling of relief. And then, of course, I also remember, since I got fourth place, that I also had to do a urine test. And I was scared, of course, that I would test positive for some drugs that maybe my mother gave me or whatever. I mean, I didn't know. She was so unpredictable, and it was just scary. Everything, every little exam you had to take, you know, am I going to pass it? Am I really a girl? And I think I was afraid of not being a girl, because when I was young, I had very short hair. My name was Tony. I was very athletic, had big shoulders, and I always had this kind of self-consciousness about being so powerful as a woman, mm-hmm. As a young girl, working out in the weight room, feeling like I wasn't feminine and feeling like boys wouldn't like me. And, you know, I had this short hair, and, you know, sometimes people would say, Tony, are you a boy? And I, no. So when I went for the sex test, I was like, oh God, what if I am a boy? What if I am? And I just didn't know it. I was so relieved.
Yeah, that's a great description of the kinds of psychological anxiety that these kinds of issues bring on. So you do remember being tested for banned or performance enhancing substances after your race, and they did a urine test. So how did you feel about having, you know, your bodily cells and fluids removed? How did you feel about that? Did you feel invaded, or?
I felt nervous and scared that I just wouldn't pass the test, or that they would find something that they hope they wouldn't find, or that they weren't expecting, or that, you know, they'd find out you're really a boy or part boy, or that you're really, you know, have something in your system that's not going to pass. Or in terms of the testing at high altitude in 1965, I think I was just, I'm terrified of needles, and yeah, I was scared. I was really, it's a little traumatizing for me to have needles injected into me and stuff like that. And that probably comes from some kind of experience from when I was young. I went to my mother's doctor once when I was young, and he was an adult doctor, I think, or gynecologist or something, and they took my blood out, and it was like, I remember it looked like a spear going into my arm, and I saw this thing coming at me, and I swear to God, the closer it got to me, the bigger the needle looked like it was getting, and oh, I was just like hysterical. Anyway, so I, from that time on, kind of had this issue with needles. I still do, actually.
Well, that's so do I.
Yeah. But acupuncture doesn't bother me, which is kind of odd. Go ahead.
Do you remember having heard any rumors about other athletes or teams, other national teams, maybe using performance-enhancing substances? Or do you remember hearing about anyone being disqualified during those games? And what were the your teammates and coaches saying about banned and performance-enhancing substances?
I don't recall that there was much said. I don't think that the swimmers were really under the spotlight in regards to that. It was mostly the track and field athletes from the Eastern Bloc countries, there was a concern. I don't recall if anybody got kicked out for that reason. And I don't recall that there was really much discussion about it, because, you know, I kept pretty much to myself. And I think, and the odd thing is that I just got my boxes back from, my mother was holding some boxes in storage for years. And she died a couple of years ago, and I just got them back in November. My brother gave them to me, and I found my little diary that I wrote. And that while I was at training camp, only at training camp. And I went through the whole thing, and I never wrote one thing down about my grief and disappointment of being abandoned by my coach. It was all this kind of upbeat, sort of flowery stuff, you know, about workout and how well I was doing, and about the, I don't know, the Mr. Richards, who owned Richards Market, sent me some spare ribs and a chocolate angel food cake for my birthday with my mother when she came to visit me and for my birthday, and, you know, kind of really lighthearted things. There was nothing negative in the journal, and yet my memory of that crushing blow is so powerful, but I never wrote about it. So, you know, I think there's a lot of stuff that back in those days that we didn't talk about, maybe because we didn't understand it, maybe because of a fear, or maybe because we were just young. I mean, I was only 16, just turned 17 when I was at training camp. And I think you're really self-conscious about, you know, being in puberty or being a young woman and all that. And you don't really understand what all the this drug enhancing thing is. I don't think we really had, I never had a real conversation with somebody about it.
Mm-hmm. During your actual competition events, during the 68 games, do you recall how the swim teams were interacting? So, for example, how the U.S. swim team was interacting with the Soviet swim team. Did there seem to be any tension between the Soviet bloc teams and the U.S. national team?
I don't think so. I mean, not that I recognize, because personally, my curiosity is supersedes any kind of fear I had. I just always felt as though, you know, they're just human beings. And Propinpenko proved that to me when I was 13, that you reach beyond all the political hoo-ha and propaganda, and you see that they're just human beings, just like you. I certainly think that when Hungary came through the stadium, I was really excited because it was, again, you know, showing courage in the face of adversity. But it wasn't about the athletes. It was about the government. It was about the foolishness of the government, not about the people. Mm-hmm. I don't feel that. I do think that on the U.S. team, there was a tremendous divide between the Caucasians and the blacks. Maybe, again, it was in the middle of the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement. People were terrified of black people, especially exerting their independence and their thinking and their personalities. And I thought in a very dignified way, to raise awareness of what the real situation was with black people in the United States. I thought it was very apropos given what was going on in the United States at the time with the civil rights movement. But it was also scary. You know, it was terrifying because people at that time wanted to say, well, this is not a political platform for you in which you can take these kind of actions. But in fact, you know, as we all know now, the politics is what the reality is, and the lack of politics is a mythology. I mean, you look at any Olympic Games, and you can see it, certainly in 72 with the massacre, and 76 with the, I think it was the African countries that didn't go, and then in 1980, when the U.S. didn't go, which I thought was very interesting. If you have a chance, talk to Andy Strank about 1984 and the Russians being in the Eastern Bloc countries, not that whole situation. If you haven't talked to him yet about that, you should call him and ask him what his situation was. He was one of the guys who went over as a part of a, you know, entourage to speak with the Eastern Bloc countries on behalf of the U.S. Olympic team in 1984. And the actions that weren't taken and the actions that were taken that led to the Russians and the Eastern Bloc countries pulling out. Very interesting story that you were. I've never read anywhere else, but Andy was a part of that. So if you have a chance, give him a call and talk to him about it.
Thank you for that tip, by the way, about Andy. I wanted to ask you about the media. What are your memories of the media presence, the TV cameras? Did anyone talk about seeing any of the swimming events on TV back home, photographers, reporters, journalists?
Well, it was many years later, I guess about 15 years ago, when I went over to a dinner. Henry Cervantes is the man I consider my dad, and he has relatives that I really didn't know very well, but we went over to a dinner at his cousin's house or something like that, and there was this guy there who was a little bit younger than me. My dad used to call him Fideo, which meant spaghetti, I guess, in Spanish or something, but because he was tall and skinny. And he told me that when I was down in Mexico, that the whole family from his side were sitting in front of the TV and watching me compete. It was the first time in my life that I ever thought or really realized that there was somebody who was rooting for me.
Oh.
And I thought, oh my God, really? Wow. And it just never occurred to me because I was so blinded by this being abandoned, this feeling of abandonment when I was in Mexico. It's like, wow, there really were people who were kind of on my side. And so as far as the media in the village, I just remember when Tommy Jet Smith and Juan Carlos were being taken, removed from the dormitories, and removed from the premises, that the press was there and the hoo-ha, and it was pretty dramatic. And watching this and thinking, God, this is just wrong. I don't recall that I saw very much of it myself on television. I tried to go to as many events as I could when I wasn't swimming myself. I do remember George Foreman and him waving his flag. That was sort of the anecdote to Tommy Smith and Juan Carlos, when he became sort of the hero of the games for having displayed that. And, you know, good for him. That's the way he felt. And so, yeah. And I think the country was really divided over Mexico City because of all of the social implications of what was happening and what was occurring back home. It was really just a microcosm of what was going on in the States.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I do feel that a lot of the athletes reached across the table to each other with curiosity about what was going on. There was exchanges of sweatsuits and swimsuits and, you know, robes and all kinds of little pins and things like that. There was a big exchange and a big curiosity, and I think that we were really a reflection of the best of humanity in some ways, and also the worst. You know, it was the coaches who were the ones who wanted to throw me off the team. You know, a different generation who grew up with prejudice. I don't recall anybody on the swim team gave me a hard time about it. And if they did, it was behind my back. But it was the older people, the other older generation, who were having a problem with it.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of Mexico in general and of Mexico City and the native peoples there?
I didn't have a lot of interaction with the people when I was there. 1965, I probably remember more because of a smaller scale, and I always found them to be very nice. What I do remember, one of the things that I remember that I will never forget, is Miguel Echevarria, who was picked to win the 1500 meters. He was Mexican. And Michael Burton. Mike Burton won the 1500 meters. Echevarria, I think, came in eighth or something, didn't even get a medal. And the Mexican fans booed him. And he, I remember him walking off the pool deck, just hanging his head in shame. And I was thinking, this is just wrong. How could they do that to him, you know? And of course, when Felipe Munoz won the 100 or 200 meter breaststroke by surprise, you know, it wasn't expected that he would. He became a national hero. But I remember the contrast of Felipe Munoz and Echevarria, of how uncompassionate the people can be. And I really felt for him. I really felt for him. It was a harsh, harsh reaction to him having lost.
Gosh. Are there any other memorable or interesting events or experiences that you want to tell us about before we go on to the closing ceremony and what happened after the games?
I remember before I swam my 200 butterfly, my coach knew that I'd had some problems with my mother, and he was I guess trying to make up for having not shown up for my first my first two events. He missed the prelims and the semifinals of the 100 butterfly, and he was there for the finals and then the semifinals and finals of the 200 butterfly. He sat me down, and he knew that my mother was tormenting me, and he just said, win, lose, or draw, I love you anyway. And that was before the finals of the 200 butterfly, and after I lost, my mother turned around and walked away from me, and she wouldn't speak to me in the elevator, and I remember I just wanted to be held by her. And she wouldn't talk to me. And I don't even remember. It was a couple of days, I think, before she talked to me. And I just remember feeling very ashamed because I'd lost. Feeling like I let everybody down, that I wasn't strong, that I wasn't powerful, that I was weak, you know, that I wasn't mentally tough, all of those things, you know, that I felt. And so I really felt for Echevarria. You know, I've always been kind of for the underdog in my own way. Maybe that's why I was, you know, very interested in the civil rights movement. Very interested in people who are courageous and stand up for their beliefs against all odds and against adversity. Those are the people that influenced me the most.
Mm-hmm.
My other experiences, I think that one of the things that I learned looking back, you know, after doing a lot of self-examination, if I were going to pass on any words of wisdom to anybody, it would be to speak. Whatever you're feeling, just communicate with somebody. Let them know how you're feeling. Let them know you need help. Don't be afraid of don't feel like you're kind of doing this whole thing by yourself. You know, find somebody who will support you and help you that you can confide in, because I was embarrassed and didn't want to say anything about needing extra blankets. I didn't feel there was anybody I could go to about needing help with my training. I couldn't tell Newland how heartbroken I was and or get upset with him and tell him how angry I was that he was letting me down and did he know what this meant to me. And the other thing I would say is that to anybody who knows an athlete, I mean, I've had many people say, oh, you got fourth, oh, you're a loser. You know, if you get second place, you're a loser. You know, you're only a winner if you get first place. And if there's anything that I can do to change the attitudes of other people, it's like I would say that you never know on any given day what that person is going through. You don't know. And I think it came home to me, oddly enough, some years later when the pole vaulter from Russia, who had the top 20 jumps of all time, he held the world record, he'd broken the world record so many times, and he'd done 20 jumps, something like that, higher than anybody else. He went to the Olympics. He was an absolute shoo-in for a gold medal. He didn't even win a medal. I don't even know what place he got. I think he got fifth place. And I thought to myself, here's a guy who, by any stretch of the imagination, should have won with his hand tied behind his back. He didn't. Why didn't he? Well, the question is because we don't know what he was going through on the day that he had to do it. Maybe somebody died in his family. Maybe, who knows? You just don't know. So before anybody is judgmental about somebody else, be compassionate, because you don't know.
That's excellent advice, definitely. Were you there for the closing ceremony?
Yeah, I was. I was there for the closing ceremonies. And of course, there was a bittersweet feeling about it. Feeling really excited about having all of these international experiences, being a part of a historical time in the context of the whole entire year, 1968. I mean, this was really an amazing, amazing year. And also the bittersweet feeling that I held of being a victim of a racial prejudice from my own team, and seeing the racial prejudice towards other people on the team, and the hypocrisy. I think that's the thing that affected me the most, was the absolute hypocrisy of that experience of glorifying gold medal winners and medal winners, and really being very patriotic, and then people going back to their own country after having done a great service and being ignored.
So what did you do right after the games? Did you have to return immediately to school or training? Did you have time off?
I went back to high school. I was finishing the semester. I think I missed the first quarter because the Olympics were in the fall instead of the summer, which was, incidentally, generally our off season is the fall. And so to have extended the season past the summer into the fall it was just different. It kind of threw you off a little bit, but also the weather, I don't know why they chose that time, because it was freaking freezing there. It was cold in Mexico in the fall. Why didn't they do it in the summer? I don't know. Anyway, so I went back to high school. There was a presentation ceremony at the football game, the first one that I went back, and I remember when I was so ashamed that I had lost. And I remember my first day at school, I'm walking through the hallways just feeling horrible and embarrassed. And all of a sudden I see a couple of girls that I know that I considered the girls that I knew the best, even though I didn't spend a lot of time with them, and they happened to have been together walking up the hallway when they saw me. And they all came running towards me and, smiling and laughing and threw their arms around me. Yeah, it was nice because I felt as though they cared for me anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice. So after that, what did I do? I just, I think I took some time off and started training again in January. And then I swam through the summer and retired. and went off to school, and I started to swim a little bit at UCLA, but there was no real program, you know, for girls. I was kind of training with the boys team, and, you know, it just, my heart wasn't in it. I just wanted to do other things. It was 1969 and 1970 were the sort of crescendo of the anti-war movement was going on. I got very involved with that. I was interested in things much, which I thought were much greater and much more important than swimming. And that was really just a continuation of my experience in Mexico of becoming very, very aware of the Vietnam War and the inequities of it. And I became a peace activist and still am to this day.
That's wonderful. So what kinds of feelings or thoughts did you have about deciding to leave or retire from the sport?
Oh, I was really ready. I mean, it wasn't kind of a conscious thing where I said, okay, I quit. It just kind of faded away. In fact, it just kind of faded away. I went to UCLA after I graduated from high school. I swam that summer, defended my title, and got third place. It was another very emotional time with my coach. When I decided to go to UCLA instead of UC Irvine, he decided he was going to stop coaching me altogether 3 weeks before the Nationals. And so I did pretty well considering I was, again, emotionally not in a great place. And then went to UCLA and made a very, very lame effort at swimming. I really didn't want to do it, but my mother wanted me to, and, you know, but then it just faded away, and I was just glad. I wanted to do other things. I wanted to date. I wanted to have sex. I wanted to smoke pot. I wanted to, you know, study and be a part of this movement and be a hippie and try LSD. I mean, I wanted to do everything, and I did. I did it all. You know, I had a very, very interesting time, and I don't regret it at all. It was, it was just such an interesting time with the music and the hippie movement and the gay and lesbian music movement, the feminist movement, the Black Power movement, and, you know, the anti-war movement. I mean, there was so much going on at that time, and I just wanted to be a part of it all.
Well, it sounds like things worked out for the best and that you did have a wonderful, wonderful time. But do you think if there had been Title IX and there had been a strong program for women swimming at UCLA at the time, do you think you would have continued or would you have still taken the same path?
It was a very, very different attitude at that time. I don't know if anybody's told you this, but the general consensus, accepted consensus at that time, was that girls reached their peak when they were 16 or 17 or 18 years old, that it was downhill from there, that they would not get better, they wouldn't get faster, that it was over for them. This was the accepted thinking of the time. So, would I have continued? I don't know. I mean, I've sort of bought into that whole thing that, you know, I'm over the hill, and I wanted to do other things. I think that the whole culture would have had to have had a different mindset for me to feel as though there was an advantage for me to continue to swim. I mean, to me, swimming at that point was taking away from living my life.
I see.
Now, it's very different now because now, you know, you can get a scholarship and you get support if you're good enough for your swimming. So, you know, the whole onus isn't on you. I had to go and work 3 jobs to put myself through school. You know, I didn't have anybody helping me. If I wanted to go to school, I had to pay for it, you know, because my mother wasn't, she paid for the first year. And then after that, I left home, and I've been on my own completely since I was 18. But, you know, that whole thing evolved where there was, and even now I think there's a dispute about how much money is going to women's sports and it's taken away from men's sports. There's still a dispute about that. But back in those days, right at the beginning when Title IX came into being, which I think was in the mid-70s or something like that, that whole thing had to evolve. And also the whole amateur status philosophy had to evolve as well. You know, what is an amateur? What is a professional? You know, all of these concepts had to evolve, I think, to get to the point where I would feel as though I could, I would have stayed in the game. Mm-hmm. It was too soon for me to stay in the game. You know, we hadn't gotten to that place yet, and I was way too interested in what was going on outside the swimming pool. I mean, just think about it. For 8, 9, 10 years, your view of the world is as wide as the lane lines in the swimming pool. That's it. That's your world.
It's very true.
You're immersed in water. You don't see nature. You don't see, you know, you don't hear the sounds of nature out there. If you're running, you know, at least you get to see what's going on around you. When you're swimming, you're in a like a bubble. And you don't hear anything. And you just see the bottom black line on the bottom of the swimming pool. And your world is as wide as the lines you're swimming in. That's it. And man, I just wanted to bust out, and that's what I did.
That's a great description of what that life is like when you're an athlete, an Olympic athlete or an elite athlete, especially in swimming. So you already gave some great advice for people in sports or Olympic hopefuls, but what one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
To trust yourself, trust your intuition, and speak up. Go ahead.
Do you have any other thoughts about amateurism? Like maybe amateurism then in 68 versus today, and how might someone who wants to be an Olympian, how they might navigate that system?
You know, I have a lot of conflicted feelings about the whole professionalism, and there is a certain beauty to amateurism. There is a certain understanding about the value of being able to make some kind of a living from your sport so that if you want to continue, you can do it, that you'll be rewarded for it. What I don't understand is the NBA team going to the Olympics and playing against a bunch of other NBA players who are all multimillionaires. I don't understand that. I don't know where the middle ground is, however. I don't know how you navigate or negotiate some kind of middle ground, but I think some purity has gone out of athletics, and I don't watch the basketball anymore on the Olympics. I don't know how you sort of equalize the basis for everybody. I don't like the idea of amateurism, complete amateurism, but I also don't like the other extreme of these multimillionaires coming there and winning gold medals. I mean, that's just a bunch of bullshit. I don't like it. It doesn't feel right. I think it takes away from some of the beauty of those sports where people don't have that kind of advantage of making that kind of money. I don't know. I don't know. It's a question that I think deserves a lot of debate.
Definitely, and I think there will be some debate about it for quite a while.
Yeah.
So now that we're approaching the 2012 London Olympic Games, and you look back at Mexico 68, what impact do you think that those particular games had in terms of the history of the Olympic Games?
I would say that Mexico was the most explosive on a cultural basis, on a sociological basis, because of all of the things that were going on worldwide. I mean, there were student protests in all over the world in 1968. I think it was the beginning of people really beginning to voice their thoughts and their feelings and their ideas and their philosophies in a really profound way that I think sort of set a legacy for now. You know, I certainly think that 1972 was totally inappropriate expression of political ideas, because you're injuring an athlete who has taken advantage of a platform in which you're denying an athlete the opportunity to make their own statement after years of training. It's the same way I feel about 1980 when we pulled out of the Olympics because of Afghanistan. I think that that's a hypocrisy on the part of Carter, whom I really admire as a human being, but I think that was a huge mistake on his part. As well in 1984 to pull out because of, for whatever reasons that Andy will tell you, and you should call him Andy Strink. But, you know, I think the Olympic continues to be used for political gain, you know, either to have greater recognition on the world platform, in the world stage, you know, or to show acceptance by the world, by, for example, with China, you know, they used to not be able to be a part of the Olympics because of their communism. So what do? Now they get the Olympics. So, you know, it's very... The Olympics is really emblematic of tremendous changes in society and changes in the political realm of the world. And it continues to be so, I think. And I think it probably always will be a political platform of some sort.
Yes.
So, yeah.
That's a wonderful summary of what the Olympics symbolize, definitely. So before we close the interview, is there anything else that you would like to tell us about?
Let's see. Anything else I'd like to tell you about? Gosh, I can't think of anything right now. I pretty much told you a lot of stuff I haven't really talked to anybody else about. But I do think, you know, I've never talked about this actually with the prejudice that I felt myself. Because again, it was something that I was ashamed of, and it's now becoming through analysis that I feel like, not analysis, self-analysis, that I feel as though that this was a wrong, that and it comes from ignorance. And I think that if I've learned anything through this, and I try to carry this through in my work as well, is that judge a culture and a people by their life experience. And not by your own, because our standard of living and our thinking is so different than everybody else's. And, you know, maybe you think we're the greatest country in the world, but really on a lot of levels we're not, educationally, health-wise. You know, a lot of areas, the United States is like 15th or 18th in the world. And so I would hope that Americans would appreciate the value of what every country and culture has to offer and to learn from it and not feel so xenophobic about being American.
That's great, you know, advice. Wonderful advice.
There's a lot to learn, yeah.
And I hope that you know, through Olympism, that's something that people can learn, because it seems like that's definitely an impression that you got being exposed to other cultures.
It is. It's phenomenal. I mean, that's what makes this planet so fascinating, so wonderful, so great to live in, is that all the differences that are between us, all the beauty that people have to offer, and that everybody, no matter what your culture is, everybody's a human being. We all have, you know, John F. Kennedy said it the best, and if I could paraphrase it, he said, let me think if I can remember what he said, but he said, we all breathe the same air, we all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal.
Well said.
Yeah.
Well, Tony, yeah, I think
that's how I feel.
That's a great sentiment. I think this closes the interview, unless there's anything else.
Nope, that's it. I think I've said plenty.
Well,
so there we go.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about your experiences in the 68 Games. I'm going to go ahead and shut off the recorder, and then we'll just wrap up a few things then.